Hi, and welcome to the AA Grapevine. I'm your volunteer reader, Shelley Miller. Today I'll be reading from the November 2024 issue of the AA Grapevine. This is the first part of three parts for the month, and our first group of articles are about the neurodivergence in AA. Let's get started. And our first story is entitled, Different But Not Different. A woman with Down syndrome finds that when it comes to alcoholism, she's just like everyone else. When I was brought into this world, I was diagnosed with Down syndrome, and I spent a lot of my childhood in hospitals. My parents taught me sign language until I developed muscles in my mouth. The nurses and doctors taught me how to walk and talk. I learned much more slowly than other children, and I began to talk later, too. I also had open heart surgery. In elementary school, I learned how to write and do math. I was able to join the school drill team, and I even tried out for cheerleading and dancing and music. I did presentations, and I got used to speaking in front of people, but I was teased and laughed at because of my disability. I was constantly picked on because I was different. I also wore glasses and had a big perm. My mom and dad started groups with parents who had children that were born with Down syndrome. When I turned 13, I had my very first crush on boys. I began smoking in the girls' bathroom and cutting classes. Later on in high school, I got involved with an older guy and started having sex and drinking a lot. That's when I moved out to live with him. We were even engaged for a while until I cheated on him with a younger guy. My drinking became a real problem. Alcohol became my best friend. I used to say that I would only drink at holidays, weddings, and birthday parties. My life was totally going downhill. I was lying to my family. I was out of control. I put my parents and my brother through a lot of heartache and misery, as well as myself. My family was really worried about me. I got into two really bad relationships. One guy used me for sex, and the younger one pushed me out of my bedroom window and shattered my ankle. For the rest of my life, I will have to live with a limp. I missed work for 6 months while my ankle healed. My mom and my brother waited on me day and night and brought me food and juice. I had to keep my leg elevated and sleep on the couch. But as soon as I got better, I went out and got drunk. I was a mess. One day, my mom and brother held an intervention. They told me to get help. I had to decide if I wanted to live or die. I chose to live, so I went to AA. I started going to a lot of meetings. I soon became very active in service work. First, I became the special needs and events co-chair for the Wisconsin bid for ICKYPA. Then I was the Grapevine rep for the Well Group in Wales. I was also an alternate DCM for District 27 and worked with special needs. I've developed a lot of friendships with people in the program. Currently, my home group is the Badger Group that meets on Thursdays at 8 p.m. I want to thank my first sponsor from the Solutions Group for giving me a good foundation, and my second sponsor from the Well Group for getting me to the ninth step. She means a lot to me because she came to me with me to my father's funeral. Now I'm working the steps again with my third sponsor from the Badger Group. She's a little hard, but I need that. She reminds me to watch my actions and dress appropriately for meetings and conferences. She helps me no matter what I'm going through and keeps reminding me to slow down whenever I'm in a hurry. I'm getting strength back into my ankle so I can actually walk the way I used to walk. I'm also transitioning to move out on my own soon. I'm exploring my options about where I want to live, but it needs to be on the Milwaukee bus line because I don't want to keep depending on my mother and my brother to drive me around. I will never be able to drive a car because of my disability. My mom has been there for me her whole life. I put her through a lot of hell. She used to watch me throw up on myself. I would lie to her and not come home or call her. Now she can finally trust me again. I love my mom a whole lot. I'm coming up on 8 years of continuous sobriety now. My life is so much better. And even though it's been a really hard journey to not drink, I do know that I can't do it alone. I still go to lots of meetings, so much that my mom told me that I'm addicted to meetings and I should be going to Meetings Anonymous. I stay close to the fellowship and I want to keep going to any lengths to stay sober. I want to become a better sister, daughter, cousin, lover, and friend. Signed, Neely R. in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And our next story is entitled, Rebuilding. When he realized he had dyslexia, he got outside help, shared about it, and found his place in AA. My three-piece business suit exuded success. In fact, my personal life and my business life were doing very, very well. But something was wrong. Late in the third year of my sobriety, when I was visiting New York City and attending a meeting, a very charming woman asked me to read a chapter from the Big Book as part of the opening of that meeting. Suddenly, I felt trapped. I got through that reading slowly, painfully, with hesitations, corrections, and repetitions. It appeared that the stress so evident in my reading was due to the depth and profundity of the Big Book passage. But the real stress was from my fear of being identified as a learning disabled person who could barely read at all. The speaker who followed me was an experienced Broadway actor whose delivery was superb. The contrast was devastating. I got out of that meeting right away without talking to anyone. I was close to a slip. I walked miles and miles through many Manhattan neighborhoods with my jaws locked, grinding my teeth. I kept searching for an answer. Months later, through the fog, I began to tie the word dyslexia with what it meant. Yes, I reversed letters and numbers, flip suffixes and prefixes, miss whole words and sentences, invert in certain letters, and need many repetitious readings to get the true meaning of the written word. But I am also an alcoholic, and just as with my alcoholism, I slowly began to realize there was something I could do about my dyslexia. It took 6 months to get an appointment with a specialist on Long Island who works with a lot of dyslexics, and while waiting, I began to discuss my situation with other alcoholics. The more I shared about both my dyslexia and my alcoholism, the more comfortable I became with myself. During my early years in the program, when so many things were going right for me, somehow I did not have the serenity I both saw and heard in other members. Friends in the program had repeatedly suggested taking a thorough and honest fourth and fifth step. Yet how could I put something into a fourth step if I didn't know what it was? My sobriety had become like a balloon that had risen up to a very hard ceiling and was stuck there. That dyslexic ceiling kept crashing down on me and nearly cost me my sobriety. Gradually, I realized that by sharing the real me, dyslexic alcoholic, I had begun to take action on the very thing which caused so much of my confusion, terror, and resentment. My balloon was now free to search the world for ways to build and rebuild through diet, special exercises, and learning systems designed to repair or replace those damaged or missing nerves and tissues. Today, when asked to read something at a meeting, I accept without fear. My opening remarks identify me as an alcoholic with dyslexia, one who is a slow reader, prone to error, and then I thank the group for the opportunity to practice building compensating brain circuits among friends. Signed, Ben B. in St. Paul, Minnesota. And this story is entitled, I Hear the Message. A man who can't read gets a big bag of surprises, and what pours out is years of love and kindness. I was still drinking when I came to my first meeting. For a year and a half, I changed my sobriety date many times. By God's grace, I finally got sober on December 23, 1970. I'm not only an alcoholic, but I suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, and because of that, God has sent teachers my way. Everyone in my home group knew that I couldn't read, but nothing was ever said. At 4 months of sobriety, I walked into my regular Saturday night meeting with a long timer presented me with a brown paper bag. I asked, "What's this?" He said, "You'll understand when you get home, and don't tell anyone what I've done." I couldn't wait to get home. I looked inside the bag, and in it were 17 90-minute tapes. He had read the entire Big Book on tape for me. The following Saturday, he explained, "If you're going to be successful in AA, you need to know what's in that book, and now you do." In my first year, a young couple read and taped Grapevine for me each month. After 5 years, an AA buddy helped me get a driver's license by reading the manual on tape for me. Since I'd been in the military, another member said that I should go to the VA hospital for an evaluation. So I saw a specialist and was diagnosed as dyslexic. He also found me a teacher at the local community college who gave me private lessons to help me read better. I later became eligible for talking books and a reading group for the blind, read all my textbooks and all my AA books onto tape for me, and that helped me get my GED. At 10 years sober, my sponsor arranged for me to do a service taping, AA conventions. I told him I was not capable because of my dyslexia. He said that he and three other men would set everything up, and all I had to do was go and do it. Before I started, I spoke with my wife, who said she would help. My children were very young then, and five of us started to go to AA conferences. Today, luckily, AA literature is available on tape. I also can listen to the grapevine on my smartphone, which I enjoy a lot. When I was new in AA, a member said that if you didn't have a God that was big enough, kind enough, and good enough, he would share his God with anyone who needed one. I remember saying to myself, yes, I'll borrow his God. It took me 8 years to return his HP. I thanked him for the use of his God because I had now found my own. Thank you, higher power, for all the help these many years. Signed, Mac MC from Pitcairn, Pennsylvania. Our next story is entitled, Listening to Life. Once lost and now sober, an autistic member finally finds the truth about himself. To him, it's music. I was born to a mother who had mental illness. I had two older sisters who were also mentally ill. When I was 10, my dad died of a heart attack. He was 46, and this left me and my younger brother in a household of violence, psychological disorders, grief, and alcohol and drug use. Our family was irretrievably broken. That's just how things were. There were no adults home a lot of the time. My mom had to be hospitalized for a period. While she was away, my only friend at the time, an older boy who lived in foster care down the street, molested me. I just figured that somehow I made him angry. I did learn one thing in all this, however. I did better when I kept to myself and tried to figure the world out as best I could. Though I was sure that I was just like everyone else, it turns out, as I would learn at the age of 52, that I have autism. There's a saying, if you met one person with autism, then you've met one person with autism. We're all different. The well-known professor of animal science, Temple Grandin, who has autism, reflected that she processed the world through pictures. The world for her is visual. My way is through sound. I started piano lessons at age 3 and was admitted to the Academy of Student Musicians at 5. Music was easy for me. Unfortunately, I found lessons, especially classical music lessons, to be boring as hell. As soon as I passed the entrance recital test, I quit. But my world isn't just sound. I process everything I experience as if it were music. I listen to what I see, think, feel, touch, and in any way experience. I listen my way through math proofs and science and relationships. Life is one continuous, flowing, endless, and never repeating piece of music in which I'm immersed. I've never known any other life. Growing up, I was certain that everyone else processed the world the way I did. And when people disagreed with me, I didn't understand that they had a different perspective. I thought they were being mean. I didn't know any better. Once I settled into remaining isolated and reading all I could, I excelled in my studies. In college, I loved the structure of math and saw it as a kind of music we played together. While poetry was music designed for soloists, as I saw it, these were exactly the same subject. I started drinking alcohol at age 11 and added drugs in college. The more the pressure mounted for me to pick a career path, the more I visited the bar. In 1987, on my birthday, my friends and I got drunk and dropped acid. I freaked out and ran into a building, climbed 4 flights of stairs, climbed over a railing, spread my arms wide, and giving myself to God because I felt so hopeless, leaped off. I fell headfirst onto the steps 10 feet below. To my astonishment, I didn't die. But somehow, life felt as if I knew it was over. A combination of factors shaped what followed. I would learn years later, in 2014, that I had sustained a concussion. After my fall, I found interacting with other people's language, as well as possessing any type of symbol, to be painful. My relationship with the piano was over. I had secured a full ride to a PhD in functional analysis at a major university in the South upon graduation, and now that option was gone. I couldn't explain to people what was going on in my head. Before long, I found myself sitting in a psychiatrist's office. I was given many medications. From 1989 to 2010, I was hospitalized at least once a year. Along with medications, they tried electric shocks. I was lost. I tried to survive in the outside world, and drinking was my go-to. Somehow, I was able to graduate. By 1994, I found myself renting a room near campus and spent my days floating on alcohol and sedatives. One morning, I woke up smelling something terrible. I looked down to see a lit cigarette burning its way into my mattress, and it didn't really bother me. I realized nothing bothered me. Suddenly I thought, I can't do this anymore. I managed to get to a hospital near my home. They placed me in a state-run hospital. During my first 2 weeks there, a remarkable thing happened. I met another patient who had been in AA for more than 10 years. We chatted and quickly became friends. Although she shared with me some of her journey in sobriety, at no point did she ever tell me that I had a problem, nor did she ever tell me that I should get sober. She didn't push, so I didn't have to push back. Instead, I felt respected in a new and unusual way, and this lack of preaching or drive for conversion was so new to me that I found myself listening. And later, in my cell of a room on that locked ward, I even remembered almost all of what she told me, including the 12 steps. The last thing she said to me before they shipped me away was, "If you ever do get out and you decide that you have issues like mine, the rooms of AA will welcome you, just as you are." I was released to a housing program. Upon moving in, I happened to be given an AA meeting list. I found a meeting nearby and walked there a few days later. I was welcomed at the door with a smile and a handshake. I was shown to the coffee and then to a seat. A man said, "It's going to be okay." His friendly smile and calm reassurance was why I went to my second meeting. I soon purchased a big book. As I was just starting out with AA, my life depended on getting the words right. The big book told me that if I didn't know I was an alcoholic, perhaps I should try some controlled drinking. I thought back to landing on that stairwell and finding myself not dead. I didn't want to lose my newfound sobriety to find out whether I needed a seat in AA. That just seemed silly. I was terrified to identify as an alcoholic, and I was also terrified not to. What mattered to me was what I did, not what I said. I wanted to not drink permanently, if I could. So I was relieved when I read the line that says, "Just resign from the debating society." And then even more relieved when I read in the third tradition that the only requirement was a desire to stop drinking. I didn't have to identify as anything or as having any problem. I needed help not to drink, so I asked someone to be my sponsor, and I did my best with the steps. A day at a time, I've not had a drink or drug since. At 11 years sober, I let go of cigarettes and nicotine. At 16 years sober, the doctors took me off all the high-powered meds. Initially, my whole life fell apart. I ended up on the streets on the West Coast. Then one day in 2014, someone asked, "Have you ever hit your head?" There followed visits to a neurologist and a brain rehab. With brain injury, and I was tested for autism, that was at 21 years sober. 2 years later, I was back on the East Coast, safe in a place of my own. All the old diagnoses off my record. I was figuring out a new life with correct information. I wasn't broken. I understood that people really don't process the world like I do. Some things that are very easy for me to do are very hard for others to do and see, and vice versa. 30 years later, I still remember all 18 undergraduate and graduate math courses. I took and could probably do a good job tutoring someone in any of them. But I still have a hard time asking someone in AA if they'd like to go to coffee. I can play the piano again by feel, but I still get frustrated tying my shoes. I still don't do well making a lot of eye contact. I neither believe nor don't believe in God. I'm not an agnostic in the least, and I know exactly what I believe in because I feel it. I was shown to me as I worked the steps and stayed sober, and I don't care what's true or false or right or wrong. I care about what works and what doesn't. At 25 years sober, I care more than ever about the next alcoholic. If there is someone like me out there struggling about whether or not they should stay in the fellowship and work a program because they feel lost in language games, I want them to know they're not alone. I've been there. In my experience, we have only one requirement for membership, and that's a desire to stop drinking. Whether or not someone else has that desire is none of my business. That's between them and their, well, if they stick around, I'm sure they'll get to that. Signed, Grace L. in Rochester, New York. This next story is called The Guy Who Ruined My Meeting. He's new, he comes in late, and he disrupts everything. Someone should do something. I find my seat at the front of the room, early as usual. I have long-term sobriety and still regularly attend meetings, most often here at my home group. The speaker starts to share, and I'm instantly hooked, connecting and identifying with the speaker's story. I'm wholly absorbed, listening with rapt attention. And then Keith, new to the group, loudly shuffles in, late again, jostling past me in the crowded room, the oversized bag he's dragging around hitting me in the head. By now the speaker's spell is broken and I'm furious with this inconsiderate guy who has once again ruined my meeting. Keith continues to show up late, meeting after meeting, and I obsessively rehearse in my mind what I'd like to say to him, being a good AA. I know I need to practice love and tolerance, but this is a guy who's disruptive to the entire room. I mean, isn't it for the good of the group that he not be such a distraction? I pray for God's will and remind myself that it's okay to think like a jerk. I just can't act like one. I'm going to celebrate 25 years sober, and Keith overhears me telling the meeting secretary that I'll be taking a cake the following week. Excitedly, Keith tells me that we share a birthday. He'll be celebrating 1 year, and he asks me to present him with his cake. My heart softens a little for this stranger who I've made into my nemesis. Of course I'll give you a cake. It would be my pleasure, I hear myself say. Not at all what I'd been planning to say to this guy who's been driving me nuts. The next week, Keith shows up early to the meeting wearing a suit and tie. This is a first, I mumble under my breath. The time comes to celebrate birthdays, and he's up first. I present Keith with his 1 year cake, and he's beaming at me with pride and gratitude. He explains from the podium that it's been a tough year for him. He's been undergoing brain cancer treatment and waiting for a necessary hip replacement, which is on hold until his body is strong enough for the surgery. He adds that he rides his bicycle to the meeting in terrible pain, but even that's getting harder for him. Yet despite all his hardships, the caring and support he's found in the meeting have been his lifeline. And then he thanks me, and I'm reduced to tears, my heart full of compassion and humility. It's been 4 months since Keith and I celebrated our birthdays together. I hit a 25-year milestone in my sobriety that day, but more important, I was reminded of my primary purpose and why I practice AA's principles in all my affairs. The best part of this story is I now drive Keith to the meeting each week, ensuring that we both get there on time. Signed, Robin W. in Marina Del Rey, California. And we'll wrap it up with this story entitled Darkness Visible. My drinking started when I was 17 years old. Some friends and I got a hold of some liquor and beer, which we drank in the back of my friend's truck bed. We sat drinking and smoking cigarettes. Everyone was getting pretty drunk, and although I was pretty far gone, I kept drinking that whiskey. When I came to the next morning and found my friends still passed out cold, I found some more whiskey and started drinking all over again. Something else happened to me when I was 17. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I would get manic and would run around town all day long. My bipolar goes up and down, mania and depression. When I get depressed, I'm tired and don't have any energy. In the summer, I get more manic and can just go and go and go. Then I would crash. It's hard to catch up on sleep after being manic. Bipolar makes me feel depressed, anxious, angry, paranoid, and have racing thoughts. Sometimes I have felt suicidal. My mind is not always the best place to be. My thoughts come and go very quickly. My alcoholism has led me to many dark and fearful places. I was married once and would hide my alcohol from my wife in the toilet tank or under the mattress and thought she would never look. I would go into the bathroom several times in the early morning hours to take several pulls of whiskey. I remember thinking that this hell would never come to an end. My wife would yell at me constantly to stop drinking, and I would always say, "Of course I will." But as a good alcoholic, I just drank more. Never, needless to say, finally I got divorced because of my drinking. The hell I lived back then was not really a life at all. It was just an existence. I went from one blackout to another, from one drunk to the next. I have been given a chance to start over and have a better way of life. My sponsor always tells me to go to meetings. I take this love to heart. I love going to meetings because I always feel better afterwards. I gave many good friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. My doctor got me started on medication, and I have to take many blood tests to make sure my medications are at the right levels. I find that being sober with this condition makes life easier to live well. I don't get as angry, and still my life can be hard. I get frustrated very easy. Not everyone in meetings understands me. Sometimes it's hard to move forward, but I know that the group and God's will help me to get through it. Signed, Toby M. in Estes Park, Colorado. And that's all the time we have for today for the November 2024 issue of the AA Grapevine. This has been part one. Thank you for listening. My name is Shelley Miller, and I've been your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.